Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. Now, Niamh O'Sullivan, who is a consultant curator of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University, is also a professor emeritus of visual culture at National College of Arts and Design in Dublin. First of all, you're very welcome, Niamh.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Now, it's a great pleasure to be back with you again.
Well, let me tell you, you barely had a chance by now to get on terra firma in Ireland, following what was a very interesting 9-day visit, a working visit here, one might say. I think Quinnipiac made sure you didn't get too much time in Macy's.
But that's true.
But first of all, tell us about your trip here and what you set out to do and what you accomplished.
Thank you, Adrian. Well, I arrived over Saturday week ago, and I spent a few days in Boston connecting up with colleagues there and visiting the new Macmullen Museum, which we are very jealous of. It's absolutely fantastic in Boston, the new Boston College Museum, and visiting the Brian Burns Library.
Yes.
But the main purpose of my visit was to reinstall the museum, which has been closed, as many people may know, for the last 5 months or so for upgrading and physical improvements. So we've done a lot of infrastructural work and reinstalled everything and put in a new exhibit, which I'll mention in a minute. So the museum is looking absolutely fantastic, and I hope people, you know, who've been before will come again, and people who've never been will come and see it.
Yes.
So in addition to the existing collection, which we have, which is growing all the time, and is the most extensive and the best quality art museum in relation to Ireland's Great Hunger that exists anywhere, either in Ireland or in America or indeed anywhere else. And we've also started to mark the American contribution to the Great Hunger. So we've installed a small exhibit dedicated to the Irish in Connecticut, the contribution of Eliu Burritt, who was a remarkable humanitarian from Connecticut, and his work in alerting the American people to the catastrophe that was the Great Famine, and eliciting huge support from America to Ireland. So we have installed a small exhibit dedicated to him, and that's a space that we are going to change over the years and deal with people like Asenath Nicholson and Frederick Douglass and other remarkable Americans who did so much to draw attention to the American people of the plight in Ireland. Has been reinstalled and is opening actually tomorrow.
Yes. Okay.
We hope to get lots of new visitors for that.
Let me ask you about for the benefit of those in far flung corners of the world, if you would describe to us the history of Ireland's Great Hunger. And the museum at Quinnipiac University. I prefaced that by saying that there was scant information available in my day in Mayo growing up with respect to what was known simply as the famine. Probably for good reason. We were talking about something which was still very raw. We were talking about, indeed, a period where their survivors, on top of the tremendous loss of family members and neighbors, the survivor guilt was there. And for whatever reason, in hindsight, easier to understand, the curriculum in Ireland, in the national schools and the primary schools, somehow skipped right over the famine, the great hunger, and in fact it then moved on to, of course, 1916, and this the centenary year. There wasn't a lot mentioned about that either. Again, because of, you know, the involvement of people who were still living or in fact involved in the cause. You might just give us a brief history of the Great Hunger in Ireland and what brought it about.
Yes, well, I mean, those are all very pertinent comments, Adrian, because, you know, the Great Hunger was, what was remarkable about it was that there had been other famines in Ireland, and some very, very severe famines. But what was remarkable about the Great Hunger was that it was a systematic famine that endured for 7 years. So it wasn't just one or two crop failures, but repeated failures over virtually a seven-year period. So the effects of that were cumulative. You know, people died in other years, and people suffered famine disease and all sorts of other problems, and people emigrated because, of course, there was significant emigration before the Great Famine in the 1840s. But it was the relentless, repeated crop failure from 1845 to 1852 that was so remarkable and so devastating and catastrophic about the Great Famine. And you're right about the silence. People were traumatized into silence on the one hand. On the other hand, I think probably the silence in other respects was less pervasive than was often assumed, because it came out in other ways, you know, through poetry and through song and through illustration and through literature. So I suppose the history of the Great Famine wasn't really told systematically until the 150th anniversary in the mid-1990s, right, when a large number of historians began to focus on what happened and look at different aspects of it, you know, the social aspects and the political economy and, you know, all the different work that has been done by so many illustrious historians. But until Quinnipiac University opened the Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in 2012, nobody had ever considered the visual aspects of it and how painting and illustration and other forms of visuality can tell the story. I mean, nobody can replace the work of historians, of course,
right,
but historians tend to use art as a kind of, you know, the wallpaper of history, as opposed to seeing that the visual manifestations and representations can tell the story in ways that no other medium can tell either. And that's what's so remarkable about Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. It is told purely in visual form. I go over there, you know, constantly, and I walk up the stairs to the top gallery where we have various, you know, we have the paintings and we have various multimedia interpretations of the famine. And I encounter people who sit there sobbing. And, you know, they say to me over and over again, our story is being told for the first time.
Yes.
And that is an extraordinary experience for me, to realize that Irish Americans, some 39 million of them, many of whom, not all, but many of whom were emigres from the Great Hunger, feel that, you know, they are being represented and their story is being told for the first time in the museum. So that is something that's a very moving experience for us, to know that we are managing to do that for them. We take that into a lot of other different areas. So we have a major publications program in the museum. We have produced 13 what we call famine folios, the last five of which were launched in New York University at a fantastic event last Friday night.
At Glutton and Ireland House.
That's right, yes. And we had five very illustrious scholars from very different areas. We draw on people from very disparate disciplines to get them to tell the story from different perspectives. So we had Vincent Woods doing it on poetry and the Great Hunger. Mick Maloney, of course, the great musicologist, doing one, his Across the Western Ocean Songs of Leaving and Arriving, accompanied by a CD, is a fantastic way of telling the story. Tadhg Foley from University College Galway, his one is on Death by Discourse, Political Economy and the Famine. We have a very original piece of research done by Pascal Mahony, who is an architect who's written a little book called Grim Bastilles of Despair, Poor Law Union Workhouses in Ireland.
Right.
And really, it's the first sustained piece of research on the workhouses. And Angela Burke's Memory, Forgetting, and Oral Verbal Art.
Yeah.
Angela, of course, is a great Irish scholar and Irish cultural theorist, and she has done a fantastic piece of work for us. So we launched these five. We had a great session in NYU, and Mick Maloney played for us, and it was a terrific success.
We've had Grace Brady, of course, who is the director at the Irish Hunger Museum, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Quinnipiac,
yes,
is our guest on more than one occasion here.
Sure.
Folios, were they, is this relatively new? How did, you know, the famine folios evolve?
Well, Grace and I co-edit the series, and what we wanted to do was to bring in the voices of people, including, I mean, not excluding, but including historians, but to bring in others as well. So we have people across a whole range of disciplines, from literature to poetry to music,
right,
to illustration, and so on and so forth, so that the voices and the interpretations, that the richness and the interdisciplinarity and the cross-cultural connections between all those different areas adds to something very unique and original.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been fortunate enough in managing to get people who are absolutely top of their field. You know, the great 19th century historian L. Perry Curtis,
yes,
from Brown, right, University, and Luke Gibbons, and all the authors that I mentioned recently.
Yeah.
You know, Catherine Marshall. I'm going to run out now and not be able to get to all 13, and I hope they're not listening and realize I haven't remembered them all.
No, that's all right.
But really, a superb range of, you know, absolutely top quality academics and cultural theorists,
right, it's also,
have come together to work with us on this series.
Yeah, it also
and
gives
it
us
unique.
Sorry, it gives us an opportunity also to, you know, to really, you know, emphasize that these famine folios become, you know, a unique resource for students and scholars and researchers, you know.
Exactly.
This is something that, in addition to, you know, you mentioned earlier about the world class and the world-renowned collection of visual art at Quinnipiac and the Great Irish Hunger Museum. But this is becoming, and this is a resource not just for the scholars of Quinnipiac University, but this has been opened up by virtue of the creation of the museum at Quinnipiac to begin with. This has now opened up to a whole new level, and one which, you know, takes a century. You know, a century and a half later, and takes what was little known and somewhat closeted information and brings it to life. Though many,
exactly,
one might say, though, that much more was written in Irish history about 1916 and rightly so, then of the famine to begin with, until, you know, the Christine Keneally's and those, you know, in contemporary writings, that became, you know, the first trump card, as it were, of the art world to say, well, here is the story, and this is what happened. And perhaps for the first time, you had historians and scholars pointing out that this was not just an act of God, that in fact, this could have been prevented. It could have, yes. not the famine itself, but definitely the tremendous
the extent
of it could have been prevented. Yes. And in fact, yes. That America, in no small way, not only acknowledged, but when you look at, this is pre-internet, it was pre, just about the communication of that period did bring a tremendous amount of response from all corners of North America.
You're absolutely right. And just going back to your opening point, Adrian, I think what's also very interesting, and it's a story that has yet to be told, which is the story of what people did to survive. There's a remarkable new book about to be published by Cambridge University Press by that great scholar, Brendan McSivna, and he delves into that for the first time, looking at what ordinary people did to survive. And that's a deep and dark story that people have shied away from. So there are other aspects of this that are coming out that have never been told before. So it's a deeply complex subject, as, of course, is the story of emigration. So, you know, the huge generosity of the American people in raising money and sending boatloads of food and clothes and
yes.
everything over to Ireland, and then the contrasting and sometimes paradoxical reception of the Irish when they came to America, who were perceived as, you know, dirty and diseased and drunken and indeed displaced and dislocated and
yeah.
traumatized as they were. So it's not a simple story. And there are sort of murky depths to it that need to be explored, as well as the kind of heroic survival and it's not all as simple as bad Britain
yeah.
and poor Ireland, but there are layers of complexity within that also need to be explored. So we're trying to chart that journey because it is part of what becomes the Irish diaspora and what becomes of part of what America is today too. So
right.
it's an endlessly rich subject, and
yeah.
we're doing what we can to tell that. But we're also going to do something maybe slightly unusual. In 2018, we're going to bring Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, the collection, back to Ireland in a project called Coming Home, the Art of the Great Famine. So we are going to bring that collection back to Ireland, where it's going to be shown in Dublin Castle, in the Coach House in Dublin Castle, and in Skibbereen, which were two diametrically opposed epicentres of the famine, if you like.
Yes.
And there we're going to try and explore many of those issues, the richness and the complexity and the depth of the story at the time, and also what that means to people today in Ireland and today in America, because we are all, our identity is largely formed by that experience, and it is conditioned, who we are and how we are today. So we're going to explore all of that when Quinnipiac is generous enough to send all of that back
yes.
to Ireland in 2018.
And I know that John Leahy, president, and CEO of Quinnipiac University, and the board, you know, were in Ireland recently, you know, in making those arrangements, as you know, as you have well researched there. Let me ask you though about you had mentioned earlier about other famines, shorter famines, before 1845. Were some of the previous famines, were they responsible for the immigrant wave? Because there was an immigrant, a voluntary immigrant wave which came our way. Could you just address that part and what does research show that what was the connection between famine, the fear of famine, and immigration going back prior to mid-1800s?
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right, Adrian. I mean, there were repeated cyclical famines in Ireland going way back. But as I said earlier, you know, they tended to be 1 year and then a recovery in the following year. Not that there wasn't devastation and death in that year, but it was the accumulation that was so dramatic in the mid-19th century. But you see, I think the important thing to say about the Great Hunger is that it wasn't just a seven-year event. It is about a systematic neglect of a people going back long, long, long before.
Yes.
Who lived in the most appalling conditions. Frederick Douglass described the conditions of the Irish peasant as akin to, if not worse, than the conditions of black slaves in America at that time, and we all know how bad that was.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just hunger; it was the systematic neglect and the appalling conditions in which people lived. So, yes, there was a steady stream of people attempting to escape from that awfulness.
Right.
Coming, you know, moving to Britain, where they thought they could get work, and where many of them did get work, seasonally, if not on a permanent basis.
Yes.
And then moving to Australia and to Canada, of course, and to the United States. So all of that predates the Great Famine, but then, of course, the great influx happens when, you know, year after year from 1845 to 6 to 47, 48, and so on.
Yeah.
So that is, it is, I think, that story of systematic neglect, which is the greater story, in a way.
Yeah. It draws a smile when, in fact, you underline a point that despite what is commonly referred to as the 800 years of British oppression, that Irish people, people in Ireland, would actually go to Britain and be quite welcome because the type of work that the jobs that they would fill, not unlike some of the poorest areas in the world today, and its connection with immigrants and immigration, one that that in fact obviously has historic roots in this. Yeah. You know, if a country, you know, has, if an immigrant, regardless of their backgrounds or their education or their status in life, if you can get somebody to do work that nobody else wants to do, there's an implied welcome. It doesn't always work out that way, as we well know, but there is an implied theory there that, you know, they went to Britain. They didn't go to Britain because they were going to be welcomed. They went because that was one of the few choices. And again, we might point out that before the famine, it wasn't just a question of waking up in the middle of the night and say, I think I'm going to go to America or New Zealand or anywhere else. there was a question of having enough money to get on that ship going somewhere, despite the horrific, experience of, talking about, the coffin ships heading out. There were many people who would have, many more people who would not have died in the great hunger had they the means to actually get on that ship and go somewhere.
Yes, that is true, and you know the new exhibit I mentioned earlier does deal to some extent with that issue about the one the coffin ships coming to America. Not all were coffin ships, but very many were, and people travelled in the most extraordinarily appalling conditions. Some of them half naked, with no money and
no sanitation.
Exactly.
Many who didn't have.
And on these ships, very often alcohol was sold to dehydrated people who went berserk. The conditions, the stories of those trips are simply appalling. But not all ships were like that. And then in the reverse direction, the ships of mercy going from America, such as the Jamestown, was sent by the city of Boston and captained by Robert Bennett Forbes, which went laden with 800 tons of food and I think 28 barrels of food, of clothes. So, the story is full of paradoxes. But the emigration story of people going to Britain is an interesting one because, of course, Ireland was part of the Union of Great Britain and Ireland.
Absolutely.
So they were going over to the colonial centre, but in the sense that they felt that they might have been unwelcome, but they felt they should have been entitled.
Yes.
But of course, the welcome there was very mixed. They were needed for harvesting and for seasonal work, but of course, again, they were very largely unwelcome there too.
That would continue even 100 years later, more than 100 years later, where in rural areas of Ireland, fathers, farmers in particular, would go for seasonal work and kind of disappear at night, no big slán a bhaile or so long or we'll be seeing you. There was existing even as I was growing up in Ireland. There was more than a tinge, of embarrassment with respect to the fact that those leaving to go for seasonal work, they were going out of pure necessity, nothing else.
Yes, yes. And I think it's important to remember one of our speakers at our session in NYU on Friday night, Pascal Mahoney, who wrote the folio on the workhouses that I mentioned earlier.
Poor
he spoke, he broke away from history for a minute, and he spoke about famine in the world today. And really, that is what we have to remember, that these conditions still pertain around the world. And, we shake our heads in horror and disbelief at what happened in Ireland in the 1840s and early 1850s. But around the world, the same conditions pertain. And he spoke so eloquently about the need for all of us to remember, not just to remember Ireland in the 1840s and 50s, but to remember what is going on around us and the moral responsibility that we all have to not just look back, but to look around us. And that was such a salutary, interjection from him. And I was very glad he made it, because that's what makes what we're doing in Ireland's Great Hunger Museum worthwhile, that it will, bring people to reflect upon these issues as they exist around the world today.
Maybe this sounds too much like a cliche, but, we can put a man on the moon, but somehow we're about where we were going back a couple of hundred years ago with respect to, yes. you know, men's inhumanity to men. It is it is a good reminder, but the work of Kunitia.
And so, Adrian, I don't think that can ever be a cliche because we forget it over and over and over again, don't we?
Yes, and it's easy actually not to even bring it up.
yes.
Some of that obviously exists as well. The progress that has been made since the opening of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum and indeed Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac is something that obviously has not only taken root but has really, really taken off to the point where the museum itself and the art collection, the collection of all the visual art at Quinnipiac at the Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, leads me to ask, what was the process in sourcing art during art from that the famine period there? I mean, where was the art? What was did most of that wind up in Britain? I can't imagine that there would have been art outlets during the famine in Ireland during the Great Hunger, or were there?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, again, it's one of the paradoxes of the story. Irish artists, because, you know, Ireland was such a poor place, it was very underdeveloped in all sorts of ways, so young Irish artists who wanted to make it as artists went to Britain, went to London,
yes.
which was the centre, the metropolitan centre of the art world, and that's where they went to study and to try and exhibit in the, you know, the places like the Royal Irish the Royal Academy
right.
and the British Institution and so on. The Royal Hibernian Academy, which was the Irish version, was in its infancy and would not have had the cachet of the London salons or exhibition venues at all. So they went there. And, of course, as soon as they got there, they wanted to, appear to be as un-Irish as possible because British patrons did not want to buy scenes of appalling, revolting Irish poverty, as they thought. They got there, they changed their subject matter, they changed their demeanor, they did everything to appear to be as kind of metropolitan and British as they could rather than Irish. So there is a huge paucity of images of the Irish famine because it just was not considered either decent to represent it
yeah.
and certainly patrons would not have bought it. So
how
there are very,
you,
very
yeah.
few...
As curator, though, how did you and how do you continue to source art?
Well, we have, I mean, first of all, John Leahy himself personally set out to build this collection, and he accumulated a really interesting body of work long before I came on board.
Mm-hmm.
He was assisted by Conor Kenny from Kenny's bookshop
yes,
in Galway.
Indeed.
And they amassed quite an amount of art. And then gradually, when I was brought on board, as an art historian, my job was to look into all the nooks and crannies and to find different ways of telling the story visually. So we started collecting illustrations and various other manifestations. But in between that, gradually, we have discovered that there is a body of artwork, paintings. Interestingly, many of them by British artists who went to Ireland rather than Irish artists. So we're starting to collect some of that material, and that's very interesting, how they came to Britain, or came to Ireland, and saw what was happening and started representing that. And then afterwards, my sort of mantra is that it's the long story of the famine that we tell in the museum. So we went on then collecting work that relates to, you know, the 1850s and
right.
1860s and 1870s and 1880s, when all those conditions that were laid down by the famine continue to pertain, the emigration and the poverty and the deprivation and the, you know, and so on. So there is a lot of work that tells the story retrospectively, and we started to collect that material. And then also there's a fascinating body of contemporary art by top Irish artists.
Absolutely.
Such as,
names that, by the way, if we go back a few years outside of Ireland and definitely across America, we would not have even known, you know, who they were. Again, through, you know, through Quinnipiac, through John Leahy, and through the university, not only did we get to know them, but we got to meet them. And their art is here. It must be ironic that in 2018, their work, it will be going back as part of the tremendous display and bringing that collection back to Ireland.
Yes.
Bringing it all home.
I love the circularity of that, I must say. So you know, all the kind of, you know, people like Brian McGuire and Alan O'Kelly and Huey O'Donoghue and Michael Farrell, Bobby Balla. So, you know, so their art went to America and is now going to come back. Having been rounded out and a lot of the kind of thematic resonances developed in Quinnipiac for the first time and the connections between the art of other artists and the art of the past.
Yeah.
And bringing that back to Ireland is going to be a very exciting endeavor, I think.
You know, a tune and a song which we're going to play shortly here, Pete St. John, a song, Fields of Athenry, you know, where it points out that, you know, the store Trevelyan's corn so the young might see the morn. The analysis of just that phrase is something that, you know, is a starting point, was a starting point, you know, for those to say, well, what do you mean? It's ironic, but there are so many, you know, reminders now that not only is it au fait to, you know, to talk about the famine and to present it, but it is and becomes a, you know, an obligation if we are going to, if we're going to discuss Irish history at all. This is not something that will ever again be, you know, shoved under the bed. It cannot be. It's very much a part of our history. And again, I know you've had a very successful run here. I am delighted that Quinnipiac and Quinnipiac, a Great Hunger Museum, through the famine folios, linked up with a university indeed that we're very close to, and NYU and Glucksman Ireland House, as you probably know, in our Irish Radio Network family here. My program is preceded by a program which comes from Glucksman Ireland House at NYU and hosted by Dr. Miriam Nyhan.
Yes, I know her well, and I mean, the work that both of you do in supporting our work is hugely appreciated.
I thank you for that, and I also I know a lot more to come now that the reopening of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac. We are really looking forward to to visiting and seeing all of the changes, all of which are for the better. Niamh O'Sullivan, thank you for joining us on Irish Radio.
Thank you,
Network.
Adrian. Great pleasure. thank you.
Niamh O'Sullivan, consultant, curator of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University, Professor Emeritus of Visual Culture at National College of Arts and Design in Dublin. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. We are going to get to the fields of Elton and Rye.
By a lonely prison wall, I heard a young girl calling. Michael, they have taken you away, for you stole Trevelyan's corn, so the young might see the morn. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay. Low lie the fields of Athenry, where once we watched the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing, we had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry. By a lonely prison wall, I heard a young man calling. Nothing matters, Mary, when you're free. Against the famine and the crown, I rebel, they cut me down. Now you must raise our child with dignity. Fields of Athenry, where once we watched the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing, we had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry. The prison ship sailed out against the sky, for she lived in hope and pray for her love in Botany Bay. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry. The small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing, we had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry.
The spirit of America, Mutual of America. your retirement company. Since 1945, Mutual of America has successfully served the pension and retirement needs of its customers as they plan for a financially secure future. They recognize Mutual of America's dedication to the same values that have made our country strong. Service, leadership, trust, innovation, and caring. Individuals and groups, companies and partnerships, both big and small, receive individualized retirement planning. Mutual of America offers retirement and savings products with a wide variety of investment options. Local salaried consultants manage business for the long-term interests of their customers rather than the short-term demands of the stock market. Mutual of America should be your first choice for your retirement needs. Celebrate the spirit of America. Mutual of America, your retirement company. Visit MutualofAmerica.com today. That's MutualofAmerica.com.